Well, I certainly enjoyed the book.
Great.
One of the reasons I enjoyed the book was that part of the area that you write about in the book I'm familiar with, because I'm also a Pittsburgher, or I was. I say I was a Pittsburgher. Went to high school there and graduated from high school in Aspinwall. And I worked very briefly in a little radio station in Ambridge, so I used to go through Swickley a lot. Are you, tell me about yourself a little bit. Are you with your scene setters for Mrs. Beautiful in Pittsburgh? That leads me to believe that you are from that area.
Yeah, I went to the University of Pittsburgh. I grew up in Pittsburgh and went to the Pittsburgh Public Schools. I think the only time I left it before I came down to Miami to live was when I went to the Army. I went out to Hollywood for a while, a couple of months, but mostly my life is in Pittsburgh.
What part of Pittsburgh did you live in?
Practically every part. Oakland, Squirrel Hill. I grew up in a place called the Third Ward. That's the Hill District. I think if you ever came to visit Pittsburgh, you didn't go there. It was, even as I was growing up, mostly a black neighborhood.
Still that way?
It's mostly gone now. Reclamation projects. It was the basis of my first novel, the tearing down of the Hill District, the kind of life that was destroyed and the promise of the life that was going to begin there. I didn't take an unblemished view that everything that was destroyed was worth destroying.
You get back a lot?
Yeah, my family still lives there. My wife's family still lives in Pittsburgh.
Where did you go to high school?
I went to high school, to Fifth Avenue High and Shenley High School. If people listening hear Fifth Avenue High, I'll get 7 calls at 9 o'clock the next morning because they're very loyal to the place anytime a story ever runs on me. And they mention that I went to Fifth Avenue High. I hear from people all over the country who went to Fifth Avenue High.
The Shenley Hotel plays a prominent role in your novel. As I recall, the Shenley Hotel, that is in the area near Pitt, isn't that correct?
Right. Pitt has taken it over now. It's a part of Pitt, but at the time that I'm writing about in 1909, it was a place where people like Diamond Jim Brady, Lillian Russell, Alexander Moore went to stay. It was one of the great hotels in America. And it still had that kind of skeletal quality when I was growing up. It was fun to hang around there. They have this broad veranda all the way around with chairs facing out and the big awning. Kind of exciting place, because this was probably the place where the people with the most money in the world were congregated at that moment, or 5 minutes earlier, or they'd be there 5 minutes later.
Well, when my family moved to Pittsburgh from Ohio, that's where we stayed, in the Shenley Hotel. We stayed there for quite a few weeks until my father found a house. Of course, the glory days by the early 50s of the Shenley Hotel had faded. But as I recall, there were a lot of interesting things in that neighborhood. You could walk to Carnegie Tech, as I recall. I think Forbes Field was close by, wasn't it? And mm-hmm. all of these things right in
yeah.
the neighborhood.
Soldiers and Sailors Memorial Hall, the Syria Mosque. All of these things, you know, were compared by Theodore Dreiser in one of his autobiographical works to the same scene as Rastignac in Père Goriot, when he shakes his fist at Paris, and he says to Paris he's going to conquer it. He said he had the same feeling at that exact neighborhood you're talking about in Pittsburgh. He had a feeling of shaking his fist at Forbes Street and all of those great buildings along there and saying to them, I'm going to conquer you, you're the boy from the provinces. Theodore Dreiser in Pittsburgh and Balzac in Paris. It's always had a somewhat similar quality to me. It was always something that I wanted to achieve. I didn't want to conquer it particularly, but I did want to achieve it. I wanted to understand it. I wanted to understand the music. I wanted to go to the college. Very exciting place, Oakland and Pittsburgh.
What did you study at Pitt?
English, with a creative writing emphasis. I studied there with Lawrence Lee and Edwin Peterson, mm-hmm. two good teachers, and they taught me a great deal about how to teach creative writing.
When did you graduate from Pitt?
1951. I had a B.A. in 1960. I had an M.A.
Got your M.A. there, too.
Mm-hmm.
Also in English?
English, right.
Uh-huh. And then what happened? Did you go into the Army right after that?
I went into the Army. I had come out of the Army, so I went to Pitt on a GI Bill. I went into the Army in 1946. I came out and entered Pitt in 48, then graduated in 51. I went entirely on a GI Bill. Mm-hmm. Our family wouldn't have nearly had enough money mm-hmm. to send me to college, and it's probably one of the reasons why I could take creative writing. A lot of my students today tell me their families won't let them take creative writing because it doesn't seem very practical. There was never much of a problem with my family not letting me take it since I had earned it by going into the Army to get the GI Bill.
Well, there are a lot of things that are impractical in college to study, like psychology, for example. You can't find a job as a psychologist. It's an overcrowded field. I kind of wonder what's impractical. I mean, college is not necessarily a trade school. And so it seems to me creative writing is a field that is very good for learning a lot of things about people and events that you wouldn't otherwise, simply because as a writer one is forced to think. And it would seem to me that this would be terrific training in a general sense for somebody. Now, you currently teach creative writing at the University of Miami, is that correct?
Right.
Well, what do you think about that?
Oh, I agree with you. One of the men that was in the creative writing class at Pitt with me, this was not a class that I taught, but he's, I think, a four-star general, or three- or four-star general in Germany. It certainly never impeded his functioning in a certain kind of world. One of my students is a vice president for, I think, probably the biggest music company in America. He took creative writing with me. My students, on a competitive level, I don't like to take this proprietary interest in my students. Students of creative writing, I don't know how much they're mine. They do quite well in competition with other students. They don't have any sense of deprivation. Very often, I have a lot of presidential scholars. These are the best students in the United States. They come and they're interested in creative writing. I make very clear to them, we're not teaching you scripts. We're not teaching you movies. We're not teaching you how to write screenplays. This is for poetry, the short story, and the novel. And they say yes, that's what they want.
And how they use it after they graduate is up to them. Because I would imagine that most people who study creative writing don't go out and become full-time creative writers, but they teach and they can. English degrees are pretty universal, aren't they, in
right.
terms of how you can apply it.
Right. This is This is a more specialized interest. We have a English degree with a creative writing emphasis, and then we have an interdepartmental creative writing program in which they can take a little bit of everything. We have two different kinds of creative writing courses that they could take at the University of Miami.
I wouldn't mind going getting my master's in creative writing, but I don't want to have to read Beowulf again. Can't stand it.
Well, if Beowulf is taught to you by the right teacher, it can certainly turn into an experience. I didn't have the right teacher, but since then I've heard it discussed by people who make it sound like something I've missed.
When did you go down to Miami?
1960, the same year my first novel, The Paratrooper of Mechanic Avenue, was published. I took a job that fall. The Paratrooper was published in July, and I took a job there in September.
So you went almost directly from Pittsburgh after writing this novel. How long was it between the time you went to Pittsburgh?
It was all going on at the same time. Uh-huh. I was getting a master's degree in 1960. Mm-hmm. I was working on The Paratrooper. I got the job down in Miami the same year. It all happened within a few months of each other.
Paratrooper, your thesis?
No.
What was your thesis?
The Fraudulent Artist in the Work of Henry James.
It was a scholarly piece of work.
Yeah. I was impressed by how much interest James had in the people who couldn't function in the arts, who still made careers of one kind or another by posing as artists. This runs all the way through James's work. I think as a serious writer himself and a capable and effective aesthetic writer, he understood that he was threatened as much by people who claimed to be doing what he was doing as he was by people who didn't understand remotely what he was doing, that the enemy is often within as much as it is without.
So you've been at the University of Miami for 25 years now, going on 26, I guess.
Right.
And now you're head of the department.
Well, I'm in charge of creative writing. I'm not the head of the English department. I do something separate.
How big is your creative writing department?
Well, we have about five people there, sometimes six, including Isaac Singer.
Mm-hmm. He teaches as an adjunct?
No, he's called a Stanford Distinguished Professor. That's after the name of our recent president that we had down there. Isaac has a unique sort of role. He's the first distinguished professor we've ever appointed. He's just a sort of almost regular member of the faculty. He teaches with me every spring. He comes in. We have a class of about 20 people. He and I both are in the classroom at the same time. He criticizes, I criticize. Students criticize their own work. And out of it comes some kind of synthesis, hopefully for the student, of what his work looks like.
Well, you must have a close relationship with Singer. I understand that you have translated a number of his works. Is that correct?
That's right.
From Yiddish?
Well, the way the thing functions is Singer writes the thing in Yiddish to begin with, and then he has me help him with putting it into English, acceptable English. He really, Don can do it himself. He doesn't really need me, but he thinks he needs me. So I translate from Singer's English into a kind of more general English. But I'm not the only translator he's ever had. I'm just the most recent.
Now, you don't actually translate from the Yiddish.
No.
You translate from his English because he feels uncertain about it.
Right.
Because he is a full-time writer in Yiddish.
Right. I translated most of his latest book, The Image and Other Stories. Beautiful
but translation
collection.
Is really not the right word for it, is it?
I insist on calling myself a secretary. He doesn't like it. He thinks that I'm some kind of translator. I tell him that my function is a clerk, and he says the translator is closer to it.
I imagine it's fun working with him, huh?
Great. It's fun knowing him. He's one of the important people in our time for various reasons, and being close to him is an interesting part of my life.
Well, after your first novel, tell me about the others. Now, Mrs. Beautiful is your ninth?
Right.
Well, tell me about the themes and thrust of the novels between Paratrooper and Mrs. Beautiful. Do they all take place in the Pittsburgh area?
About half of them do. Mrs. Beautiful is the second novel that I've done from a feminine point of view. My second novel, Maria Light, was from a feminine point of view. It dealt with the loneliness of a woman during World War II. My third novel dealt with my experiences working in a burlesque show, The Candy Butcher's Farewell. The fourth novel, Back to Oakland, that neighborhood that we were talking about, a man that's haunted by a ghost of something that happened in Italy during World War II. This takes place right after World War II. That's The Stranger in the Snow. The fifth novel was The Keeper, the Demon in the Sun Parlor, and that was set in Miami, a family that's obsessed with whether their son is a murderer or not. That's the one I got various screen offers on of one kind or another. The Keeper of Secrets was my sixth novel, and that was the one that I did about a writer who's on the edge of having a Nobel Prize. This was long before I met Isaac, and decides at the end he doesn't really want a Nobel Prize. He's not Nobel Prize material, and he's just a man who is going to look good, but he's never going to produce anything that's very great. And then I did two books of a saga in original paperback. They sold very well. They sold wildly, I think about a half a million copies.
A saga? A generational?
Yeah, a generational.
Where was
American
that?
Jewish family, set in the United States.
Does that count in terms of your tenure at the university?
No,
that help?
No. On the contrary, I always have a lot of explaining to do about why I decided to make some money. It's if you're a teacher, you're not supposed to make any money. I don't think those books did my reputation any good, such as it was. I don't think they did me any good. I think I worked too hard, too much detailed kind of historical examination. I should have written two of them in the space of about 8 months. Instead, I wrote two over a space closer to 4 years. I just became an expert on the subject, and this wasn't necessary. That wasn't anything that readers of that kind of book are concerned with. And it was a great relief to turn to Mrs. Beautiful and to write a serious, honest book about historical matters. I am interested in history. I am interested in the American culture. I don't think that those two saga books I did came anywhere near satisfying that kind of need, either in readership or in my own interests.
Well, Mrs. Beautiful is a serious novel, and it is very conscious stylistically, too. And you mentioned a moment ago that you were interested in the Shinley Hotel, which is where the novel, I believe, moves in its second chapter. And Roxanne, isn't it?
Right.
Marries the doorman there. But how did you happen upon this era of 1909? Was it that this was the highlight of the Shinley Hotel's history, and you want to do something that as a springboard, or what?
That's interesting, because I think every city has a kind of cultural moment, and I think that Pittsburgh's cultural moment lay somewhere between 1890 and 1915. And I thought I would capture the city in its essence, what it was, the kind of clash of robber baron mentality and extraordinarily humanistic ideals. I think these two things were in some kind of engagement at that time in Pittsburgh. Growing up in Pittsburgh, you're aware that the artifacts of the culture, many of the buildings, many of the most beautiful buildings, are buildings that reflect this kind of endless sense of optimism that there was in 1909 and 1910. And I think that Pittsburgh has always been an optimistic sort of city. It still is. People there are all cheerleaders for the place. And 1910 struck me as a kind of synthesis of the city's delight in itself. And I think the American delight in ourselves occurred as much in Pittsburgh in 1910 as it did anywhere else.
And yet there are mystical elements to the novel, too, which are reminiscent of, as I was reading your novel, I felt reminiscent of another book that I read about 2 or 3 years ago called Winter's Tale by Mark Helprin. I don't know if you happened to read that.
I read the first part of it. I read the first third of it, and I liked it. I don't know why I didn't get back. I was doing something else at the time, but I liked it a lot.
Well, there are you have the same sort of feeling. Of course, it's different in a different location, although you did put part of Mrs. Beautiful in New York City, but there is some the same sort of feeling of mystery and intrigue about it. I thought it was well done, and I congratulate you for that.
This is one of my themes. The mysticism isn't a general mysticism that simply pervades the possibilities of the characters' lives. It seems to me that it's an American trait, this belief in magic. We call it science. In its substance itself, magic is part of our lives. It's not just the way we live, kind of, as my philosophical interpretation. I believe we live as Americans with a belief in magic. We're going to take a pill to make us beautiful. We're going to take a pill that's going to make us well. We're going to pour hot water over some substance, and it's going to be absolutely marvelous. The next president is going to take us out of the darkness. We're always going to do something that isn't going to require the normal processes of orderly natural law. We're going to sidestep all of that. We're going to go from the slums to being a world heavyweight champion boxer or a singer. We're all going to do terribly well, despite all the people we see around us who don't do terribly well, even when they have a lot of money. And then we finally take on that most peculiar of all magical beliefs, that money somehow is going to cure all of our ailments. And as you know, the people in Mrs. Beautiful aren't cured at all by their money. In fact, their money gives them a whole new set of problems that they have to face in themselves.
There's something else that interested me. Mrs. Beautiful was published by a very small press, and I had never heard of the press, New Horizon Press, and I happened to notice in the publicity material that the press is operated by one of your former students. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah.
How you happen to be published by the New Horizon Press?
Well, New Horizon Press is an extension of the old Horizon Press, which was a very, very solid, good publisher who prided themselves on publishing nothing but good books, with little concession to a kind of commercial reaching out. And Joan Dunphy, who's taken over the New Horizons Press, was a student of mine about 15 years ago, bright, capable, quiet, one of those people that we were talking about that has a future no matter what she is going to major in. She took she leaned sort of towards education with a heavy interest in English, and she went ahead to take over this press and asked me if I had anything that she might be interested in. And indeed, I did, Mrs. Beautiful.
You just happened to have that
in
the typewriter, still smoking.
I was delighted that she published it, and I'm delighted with her response to the book. When I hear, as I do hear, that the book is doing well by word of mouth, this to me is magic, like other people's magic. I didn't think there was such a thing. I thought that this was a kind of thing that people made up when they explained why you weren't doing very well. You have no word of mouth on your book. But here the book is selling well. It has all sorts of places all over the country that is doing good. It's about to go into a second edition, and it's certainly all through word of mouth, and it's a kind of hopeful thing to me. I like very much the way Joan has treated the book. She's treated it seriously. I had an endless interest on her part in the book. It will not disappear from the shelves in the usual 90 days, that kind of horror that the writer experiences. No matter where you are, in the New York Times or in some recommended list somewhere, you go to New York and the bookstores don't have it. I've had this happen to me. Every writer, I suppose, who publishes for a while has it happen. You appear on all the big lists. You walk into a bookstore, they never heard of it. It's a strange, dispiriting kind of experience. I don't have it now. I have a sense that the book is around for anybody who's interested in it.
I did an interview with a writer a year or two ago, and by the time I started arranging for the interview, it was rather late. The book had already been out, and then he canceled the interview because he was ill with pneumonia or something, and then that was rescheduled about two or three weeks later, and then I came down with something, so it was rescheduled for another two or three weeks. And I have a rather long lead time into my reports, almost like a magazine, you know, 3 weeks to a month sometimes. I finally worked on it, and it was very nice. I think I did a two-part profile of this writer, J.P. Miller, in fact. He wrote The Day of Wine and Roses. And the day that the broadcast aired, I happened to be wandering in Barnes & Noble, and I saw the book Remaindered. They didn't even give that book a year. I mean, that was published, and maybe it got some distribution in the bookstores, I don't know, but it had to have been remaindered within 8 to 9 months after it first came out.
Well, and you see what happens. His name is a well-known name. A movie was made of a screenplay of his, and even that, by a book-reading public, isn't enough to sustain a publisher's interest in a book by a man like that. What happens to the literally thousands and thousands of writers who find themselves not reviewed anywhere? They don't see their books appearing anyplace, and they have that sense of isolation and emptiness. You know, America really is a one-book writer kind of place. You write one book, and your aunt heard about it, and maybe if you're brave, you write a second book, and your aunt and your uncle have heard about it, and that's that. You meet people all the time who wrote a novel a while ago and would never dream of trying to write a second novel or trying to write a third. It's just too tough. I haven't had that kind of experience. There's always been something in the books that I've written that's kept me aware of myself as a writer. The books just don't die. They're not universally read or accepted. I know that, but they just don't die that quickly, except that you do have that experience that they vanish.
Well, you know, that's something interesting. There is an ephemeral quality about books, almost in the same way as, well, you can go to conventions of ephemera where there are posters and postcards and things like that, which are made to be read and thrown out. Books are not made to be read and thrown out generally, unless they're paperback books. But that does happen to books for some reason, which is why there is a market in rare books, where rare book dealers will go out, and there are rare book fairs, where early editions of Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Ezra Pound and so forth, they sell for sometimes thousands and thousands of dollars. This is just evidence of the ephemeral quality of books, that there is a finite number of them that are printed, and usually they're kind of mistreated, I have a feeling. Somebody buys a book and they gives it to somebody else, and somebody, and they winds up in a used bookstore and this sort of thing, and it gets a little shabby along the way. So the books that are remaining, when they become, they're written by people who become cult figures like Fitzgerald, they become very, very valuable. You can't just walk into a bookstore and buy a book for that reason. One, the bookstores have a limited amount of space, and if the book doesn't seem to be selling, they don't want to keep it on the shelves. They want to put something on the shelves that do sell. So books, I was talking to Charles Kuralt recently, whose book, I can't remember the title, I should, I think it's the title of his, On the Road, I guess it's the title. I just talked to him a couple of months ago, a colleague of mine. And he says, well, it was a nice feeling for him to have taken his scripts and put them in this book, because that way he can pick it up and heft it and show his grandchildren the kinds of things he did. Because the stuff that he does on CBS, it just goes out on the airwaves and disappears. But actually, Charles is wrong. The book is printed and he can heft it and he can have a few copies, but eventually they just kind of go somewhere. They vanish.
I know. Can you imagine the feeling, though, that some of us have, who don't even have the opportunity of going out over the air, for your grandchildren to understand that while you seem to be doing what you were also doing this? You know, the thrill of writing a book is one that I've never lost. I've always felt the same way that Charles Kuralt feels, that it's something to hand to your grandchildren. Even though I don't understand what they're going to think of what it meant, it might be a two-way sword. They could say he was always too preoccupied to pay much attention to us. That's what he did with his time, and the devil with him and his books. You never know. You know what judgment history is going to make on one's grandchildren or one's grandparents. But it is a nice idea that the book is something to possess that's something of you. But I don't know that there are that many people who want to possess us. So why are they going to want to possess our books? They want your autograph, and that's always very interesting to me. Why people who don't particularly like me, you know, I don't have any great friendship with them, ask me for an autograph, and of course you put a kind of glowing autograph. I'm so delighted that anybody will buy the book that, you know, I always say the best thing that I can say. But it's kind of curious. They like my book and they like my autograph better than they like me. I've never seen any great affection for me.
Well, they don't know you, that's why.
Well, I had a student one time that I had to direct out of creative writing, a kind of older woman, and she threw one of my books on the desk, and she said to me, I could take everything except that you write this well.
Sounds like sour grapes to me. I have a colleague of mine whose father died not too long ago. He was a mystery writer by the name of Branson. I can't remember his first name. I don't follow mysteries too well, so I wasn't familiar with his work, although I had seen it occasionally in rare bookstores. I would see his books, and he never made a living at it. They had some family money, and that gave him a chance to write. And so he wrote quite a few mysteries, maybe a dozen or more. And this woman with whom I worked asked me if I could help her locate copies of her father's books, because she wanted them not only for herself. When growing up, she never thought about the books. But she wanted them for the grandchildren and people and nieces and people like that. And now she wishes that she had been a little more in tune to what her father had been doing and had made a better effort to keep his things.
I know my youngest son wasn't around when my first books were being published 25 years ago. And he's wildly enthusiastic about the whole process. And I said to him about a month ago, I said, why are you so interested, you know, in this? You were never interested when I was writing the book and I was doing research and all the rest. And he said, I didn't understand what happens when a book comes out. He said, remember, I wasn't here for the first books, you know, when you were writing those books back a long time ago. He said, this is terribly exciting, you know, to be involved with you and to know you as a writer. I just never knew you as a writer.
I don't think your family, one's family, has too much of understanding or appreciation of what one does when he or she tries to write. I recall, I'm a failed writer, would-be writer, but I pick at it occasionally. And I remember I would put my typewriter on the dining room table and I would be writing away, sometimes hour after hour, night after night, late in the evening, and my kid would come up and, at a very young age and annoy me in certain ways. And my wife would say, now, David, don't bother Daddy while he's typing. And she would say this over and over, don't bother Daddy while he's typing. And finally, you know, I just blew up. I said, I am not typing. I am writing. But even she didn't have, I mean, she thought it was just some sort of silly practice, and maybe it was, but I wanted to be treated as though I were a writer and not a typist.
I know, there's a kind of detachment that people have to what it is that you're doing. I remember one of my relatives one time, one that I used to send a copy of the book when it came out, she was telling me about a bad neighbor of hers who came to borrow her book. And she said, I told her, don't try to borrow this book, and I waited for the inevitable line, go and buy it. But no, my relative said, go to the library and get it.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
And there's no sense at all, you know, in my relative's relationship to that woman that maybe you could have gone out and bought it, because it was at those times, I think, only $3.50 a book. But my relative, if I hadn't sent her a copy, I'm sure would have put herself on the list at the library to receive it.